To KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. This is Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of the show. I want to remind you, a couple of reminders, that if you want to be on our email list and know what's coming up, email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. And you can hear us live, or you can use your smartphone, or we are now podcasting. You can just ask your smart speaker to play Disability and Progress. Very excited about that. Thanks for listening. I'm Sam Jasmine. Thanks to Charlene Dahl, who's my research woman. Also, Matt Finkel engineers this episode, and we wouldn't be on without him. So thank you, Matt. Tonight, we're speaking with Lynn Noren. Lynn is the president and CEO for RISE, and she will be talking about critical services for people with disabilities during this COVID-19 time. Good evening, Lynn, and thank you so much for joining me.
Good evening, Sam.
Well, I really appreciate it, and I want to start by asking, who is or what is RISE, and what do they do?
Sure. RISE is a nonprofit human services organization. We incorporated in 1971, so we've been around almost 50 years. And our primary aim is to unlock potential and open doors to success for people who have disabilities and other challenges. And we do that primarily through providing employment supports, some housing and life enrichment services, primarily to people with disabilities, but also we support some individuals who have economic disadvantages.
And what kind of disabilities are you generally working with?
At RISE, we're a little bit different in that we work with a broad range of different types of people with disabilities. We have programs for people with mental illness. We have programs for people with intellectual or physical disabilities. We have a statewide program for people who are deaf or hard of hearing, so a real broad range of types of supports at RISE.
Excellent. And can you give me a little bit of history about you and how you got involved with RISE?
Yeah. Well, I have had the fortune to have started at RISE when I was 19 years old. College intern. And here, some 41 years later, I'm still at RISE. So today I'm the president, but I've done many different jobs at RISE. I really grew up with the organization. And back when I started in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, disability services were just growing. And so I really had just the wonderful opportunity to really grow up at RISE throughout a lot of changes in our community for people who have disabilities. And I just can't think of a better career than what I've been able to work at RISE. So, I was also able to further my education while working at RISE, and just been really lucky to grow up in the organization.
And, you know, it seems like gone are those days.
Yeah.
You have people like long-timers like you. It seems it's more of a revolving door now. People come and go. I'm not sure if you're seeing it, but, the pay rate isn't real great. And so people tend to, the real diehards who really are meant for this love it and stay, and the ones who don't kind of come in and leave.
Yeah, it's really true. There are very few. Well, just I think in any kind of jobs, we see more people now that want to change jobs throughout their career.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I really feel like when I started at RISE, we had 6 employees, and today we have almost 500.
That's a lot.
So it's not even like the same organization, right? And so I might not have been happy to just stay if it was the same all the time. But the field of disability services has changed so much in that time that it feels like a new job all the time, and keeps me engaged and growing and thriving.
And do you have different offices throughout the Twin Cities?
We do. We have over 30 locations throughout the Twin Cities, primarily in the metro and central Minnesota areas. We do have a couple programs that are statewide programs, and we have one location in western Wisconsin.
Excellent. And you guys, I believe MORE is your parent organization or something like that. Who is MORE and what do they do?
Yeah, so MORE is a member support organization. So companies like RISE are members of MORE, and MORE supports about 120 different day and employment service providers throughout the state of Minnesota. And what MORE does for us, MORE doesn't have any staff. So it's a member-driven, volunteer-driven organization. Many of us who are members are also on the board and work to support the organization in that way. But our primary work is all around public policy and trying to advance policy for disability services, especially in the areas that we work in. So we do contract for lobbying at the legislature. And also we just work to support our members through training efforts, try to, you know, create a real collaborative process for different organizations to learn from each other, regardless of where you are in the state. It's a wonderful support, really, to its members.
And what does MORE stand for?
MORE stands for the Minnesota Organization for Habilitation and Rehabilitation.
Okay.
Kind of a mouthful.
Yes, yeah. It is.
We sort of use the tagline, "Together we are more." And
I like that.
Yeah.
That is good. Can you explain what are day employment services and how do they work?
Yeah, so one of the types of services that are provided by MORE members are services that support primarily people with intellectual disabilities, but it could be a physical disability or some other type of disability in what are called day training and habilitation services. And those are licensed by the state of Minnesota. The programs have been around for a very long time, and they support people in a number of different ways. One way could be with employment, so helping people find jobs in the community, or working sometimes at providers' locations, but really supporting people to seek employment, learn what they like about work, and really just helping them become as self-sufficient as possible through employment. Another type of programming that we provide is around life enrichment. So for individuals who maybe aren't interested in just working full-time, they want to explore other parts of their lives, and we might do art therapy or connect them with community organizations like the YMCA, and just other avenues for people to have real enriched lives within their community. We're supporting them in making those connections just to really help them live their best life possible. And a big piece of our services are to provide transportation, because a lot of people who have disabilities are unable to drive.
Mm, yeah.
And sometimes public transit is not always available either. So most of the provider organizations provide transportation. At RISE, we provide 1,500 rides every single day, or twice a day, actually. So without those transportation services, it might be very difficult for some people to get to work, or to their volunteer activity, or to the community organization that they're being connected with. So it's a very important, critical piece of our services.
Now, do you guys actually provide them, or are you paying through them through something like a Metro Mobility or something?
That's a really good question. Sometimes we do pay and support people in using public transit, Metro Mobility, or the MTC, if that's available. But in some areas, it's very difficult to access that at the correct time, or people might need more support than
right.
is available through that. So we actually provide 1,500 people at RISE Rides. We have a fleet of 150 vehicles Many of them are Lyft-equipped buses to assist people who use wheelchairs or have other mobility barriers. So we kind of do all of that. Plus, we've been really working at Rise in the last year to explore rideshare opportunities. And so we've been working on a pilot with connecting people to Lyft rides to their competitive jobs. And what we've found is that individuals are really satisfied with that service because the wait times are much less. And not only for work, but accessing the community in other ways, they've found Lyft to be a wonderful option. So that's been really positive, too.
So about how many people in Minnesota about do you think are using your services? In these types
at Rise? We served 3,500 people last year. And in the day and employment programs that we're talking about, we serve about 1,400 people every day.
That's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. Yes.
We need to take a short station break, and we will be right back.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. Are you still living and breathing? Then you are in recovery from something. That's what my podcast, Authentic, is about. All things recovery. I'm in recovery from an eating disorder. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. I'm a compulsive gambler. I have bipolar disorder. Really, the list could go on and on and on. However, the show isn't about me. Every Friday, a new episode airs featuring a guest who shares their experience, strength, and hope as it pertains to what they are in recovery from. If we help one person, then we have done our job. Guests on Authentic smash stigma, share solutions, and provide my favorite four-letter word, hope. You can listen to Authentic on KFAI.org or whatever podcast platform you use. Remember, be good to yourselves. It's important.
We're speaking with Lynn Noren, who is the president and CEO of Rise, and we're talking about this whole critical services for people with disability during this time. And Lynn, I'm curious about how programs have fared now during this COVID-19 virus. How has it affected the day programs and whatnot?
Well, it's been very interesting. For us at Rise, we have about half of our programs that are continuing to operate. So those would be more competitive employment services and rehabilitative services for people with mental illness, who, of course, continue to need support during this time. Also, we've been supporting people in their jobs throughout the state in a number of ways. But the programs that we're talking about today, the 1,400 individuals that we serve in our day and employment programs, have had to close when the stay-at-home order was issued. The Minnesota Department of Health, of course, encouraged people not to group in groups larger than 10 individuals.
Yes.
And so all of the day training rehabilitation programs throughout the state needed to suspend their operations due to the virus. So for us, that means, you know, over 1,000 people are at home every day without these services. It's been very difficult for us in a number of ways, but mostly, you know, we're just so concerned for the people that we serve who now it's been 2 months that they haven't been able to attend their program.
And now, let's see, when did they close? It was March?
Around March 19th or so, that week.
Okay. So about March 19th or so. And I want to talk about a little bit about, there is a huge, as you know, stimulus packages that are being done and promoted, and a lot of individuals got a nice stimulus check, but apparently Minnesota has not moved to provide limited financial relief to the infrastructure of disability day and employment services. Is this correct?
Yeah, that is correct. So when the crisis first happened, we worked very hard with both the state of Minnesota, Department of Human Services, as well as legislative leaders to talk about the crisis situation that providers found themselves in by closing. Mm-hmm. So for RISE, it's a kind of an easy example. So we have about 250 team members that we needed to furlough because we weren't providing those services, and we needed to try and cut expenses as best we can. And even after furloughing those employees, we still, as an organization, are losing about $800,000 each month that we're closed. And so it won't take very long for us to run out of the reserves that we've been saving over the last 50 years. So we worked with legislative leaders. We have very strong relationships with many people at the legislature, and we had bills that moved forward that would have provided either grant funding or some type of retention payment to us as providers. But unfortunately, none of that has been successful in getting passed at this point.
Really?
And part of the challenge is that the state finds itself in a pretty dire situation. If you listen to the news reports the last few weeks, the reforecasted budget shows that Minnesota is likely to have a $4 billion swing, going from $1.5 billion in surplus to now $2.5 billion in negative. And so people are afraid to commit funds because it looks like the state won't have money. And so because a lot of the funding has been earmarked towards hospitals or nursing homes or other places where people certainly have needs at this time too, we just haven't been successful in getting anything passed that would impact our programs. But we will continue to try. There's one more week of session, and so we're going to hope to get something passed. We have an action alert just went out this week. So we'll continue to work at that, but we just haven't been successful yet in having any funds passed.
Do you think all states are feeling this type of belt tightening?
I am sure that the economic crisis is very real for every single state. We have been doing research to look at what other states are doing for their day and employment service providers. Mm-hmm. And we have shared examples of other states that have provided retention payments to their providers in hopes that Minnesota might look at that as a model to help support us. I know our Wisconsin program, Wisconsin is a very interesting state, and they use a managed care approach, but they provided retention payments to us there. But Minnesota has not gone in that direction. And so we're hopeful that if we keep, advocating for that we'll be successful in getting some funding relief passed, because it'll be very difficult. And it's really like the smaller providers in greater Minnesota, there's real concerns about whether people are going to be able to reopen or not after this crisis is over because of funding constraints. So it's a very real problem.
So a couple hard questions here. Certainly there has been shortfalls before. I mean, certainly that the state we've been fairly lucrative, but we have presumably ran into debt before. What happened then?
Well, there have been times like I can think back to when we had the recession in 2008.
Right.
There were rate cuts across the board for a provider. So we took an across the board rate cut. But it certainly is that's a very different scenario than not having any revenue for 2 months. We used to get really excited and worried if there was a really bad winter and we had, a number of days when we couldn't open. And
right.
So we would work to try and get relief for that.
Yeah.
Well, this is that, times 100, right? So to not have, zero revenue, not provide any services for, 2 months with, the future is not looking, it's not going to improve really quickly because we're going to have to be very careful about reopening. So it's going to be a rough time. Now, luckily, the federal government has made unemployment
really work as a good support. So even though we've had to furlough the team members, I feel like they're being well supported in the earnings that they're getting from unemployment. And we've been able to continue their health insurance, even though they're furloughed. So that relief has been really helpful for people as individuals, but not so much for our organization as a whole.
And do you feel this is, do you think it cuts across any party lines, or is it just as a whole, they're not looking at it?
You know, that's a really good question. I feel like disability services is very much a bipartisan issue, and that we have support from both sides of the aisle. I do think that, you know, whenever we have a governor from one party or the other, sometimes it can be tough with a bipartisan legislature to get things passed. So that could be impacting it, you know. I'm certainly not being critical at all of the governor, but I just think sometimes the legislature in Minnesota reflects just what's happening in the federal government, where it's kind of split. And so it kind of paralyzes their ability to take action. There's more kind of fighting. You know, if you've watched, there's a battling about,
right,
if we weren't going to reopen, then we weren't going to have a bonding bill and blah, blah, blah. You know, it can be very difficult sometimes to get legislative action.
So, you know, they talk about one-time stimulus payments. Do you really feel like a one-time stimulus payment, if you had it, would help you? Or would you still be in a whole lot of trouble?
Well, I think that any funding relief at this point we would be just thrilled to receive. There are a couple federal bills that are in place that might provide some relief to Medicaid providers, so we're definitely advocating for that. But if the legislature were to set aside some funds that could be even used as a grant, that you could apply for to help offset the deficits, that would be most helpful. We would really appreciate, you know, any efforts to help us with funding. Another thing we worked really hard to get was the ability to provide services remotely to individuals.
Yeah.
And we just got approval last week. So 6 weeks, you know, of advocating, and last week we finally could start providing those services, but they're not available to everyone. They limited those services to only people who are living in their family home or their own home, so not for people who live in any kind of congregate setting, and that's the majority of people that we work with. And those individuals are currently experiencing, you know, loneliness and missing their friends and missing their connections. And so we just feel terrible that we haven't been able to start remote services for those individuals either.
Yeah. So do you hear from them? Like, what are they saying they're doing now during this time?
We do hear from them. One of the things that I have done a couple times since this happened is sent out I can send a voicemail or text to everybody that we serve, and so I can record a message. And then I get texts back and calls back of people saying, oh, it's so good to hear your voice. I miss everybody at RISE, and I'm lonely here at home. Or, you know, people are having to, our lives have all kind of shut down, right? People aren't able to go out in the community and do things they want to do. And so it's very isolating for people. We also have noted a lot of the individuals we serve are having increased anxiety, just like everybody in the general public as well. And so we've been trying to support people with that by making sure we have regular phone calls. There's a couple individuals that we've been meeting and walking through the park with them just as a way to try and help keep them, help with their anxiety, helping to decrease that as best we can, but certainly not much of that is fundable service that's, you know, able to be provided. Just depends on where a person lives, whether we're able to provide a remote support to them or not.
I want to talk a little bit about, I know as of Monday, at least our particular state is loosening some of the rules. Where does this stand for day employment services and whatnot?
That's a really great question. So we've been working really hard to prepare a plan for reopening. And so once the stay-at-home order is lifted, so Sunday night, after that, we're just waiting for some final guidance from the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And then most providers are planning for reopening. And I would say that most of us are planning for a phased reopening, knowing that we're going to have to implement a lot of new practices in order to make sure that everybody is safe and healthy. Most of us have used the Department of Employment and Economic Development deed created a sample plan for businesses to think through when they reopen. And so at RISE, and I'm sure all providers have created a preparedness plan for reopening. Our plan, we have a senior leader team. We've been meeting for weeks, actually, to put the plan together. Some of it involves thinking about your physical structure and how people can social distance. Some of it was about procuring equipment, so PPE, masks for everybody. We had volunteers helping us secure masks, either homemade masks or purchasing masks. We've now got over a couple thousand masks available to people for people to use when they come back. Also, you know, sanitary equipment, so hand sanitizer and all those things that are really difficult to get. We've had to make sure that that's all in place and ready. And then developing, you know, new ideas for how we're going to do work and programming that allows for people to be distant from each other, but also, once again, have those connections and services that they're so used to having and that they're missing. So we're pretty excited about that. We're going to start at RISE next week. We're hoping by Wednesday to serve starting about 15% of our total group, and then every week for the next 10 weeks, we have a plan to increase that. Ultimately, we probably will never get back to 100% until there's a vaccine. So we're thinking that some people might return part-time, we'll flex their schedules, do everything we can to get as many people engaged in services as are wanting to at this time. So
okay, so I want to break this down because I'm well aware of numbers and what has happened. And actually, I'm a cautious person in regards to this. And I do understand that people are doing their best at trying to be careful. But I also know that there are people who aren't doing their best and who are out there and with a lackadaisical attitude. It's not about them, guys. It's about everyone as a whole. And so it doesn't really matter if you're 30 and super fit and if you feel like you could weather whatever. This isn't about you. It is about who you come in contact with. It's about if you get it, where you bring it, and who you infect. And so I want to break things down a little bit because I think this is going to be a really tricky thing. And I think people are going to, I mean, it's all good and when said and done that we're going to reopen and we're going to do X, Y, Z, but you have to understand you are going to see numbers climb again when you do this opening. As far as I know, and you're going to see more deaths when you do this opening. So I'd like to talk a little bit about how we keep people safe. And so I do know in some places it's not as big as you'd like. How will you implement this 6 foot, is it 6 foot distance, or how will you do this?
So we basically took a look at each of our center-based program areas and have redesigned and reconfigured how people will interact in them. So whether that's moving around the tables and the workstations and everything, just to make sure that we have as little opportunity for people to have to be in less than 6 feet distance. So I can give you an example. Like, we have lunchroom, of course. We're going to be able to have people be distanced at lunchtime by having less people in the lunchroom at any given time. We're not going to be using our vending machines, for example, or high touch things like drinking fountains. We're going to supply bottles of water that people can throw out as soon as they're done. There's just a lot of different details that went into our plan to just make sure the environment is as safe as possible. Obviously, we're going to have to increase our cleaning and sanitizing of all the areas in between. One of the trickiest areas, to be honest, is transportation.
Yes, because that was my next question to you, because how will you deal with that? And you, in most cars, let's face it, there's not a six-foot distance unless you've got a bus or a minivan that you can do that in. And even then, you're dealing with one person at a time, basically.
Yes.
So what are your plans with that?
So our plan for transportation, and we've, like I said early on, we've been transporting about 150 people still to their jobs every day, even during the pandemic. And what we've implemented is that we have redone our routing to have no more than like six individuals in a vehicle. So one person to a row seat, or some of our vans are configured with an aisle down the middle so we can have one person on one side and one on the other.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone, when they leave their home, they take their temperature before they leave and make sure they don't have a temperature. They're asked to wash their hands and put a mask on and come out to the vehicle with the mask on. They wear the mask through their entire route. And then when people leave the vehicle, they go in and wash their hands before they take the mask off. And so we're requiring people, because it isn't easy to be always less than 6 feet apart in transit, to wear a mask during transit, including our driver. And then each route, the entire vehicle gets completely sanitized before another route would happen with that vehicle. So that's worked pretty well for the people that we've been transporting so far.
And you do, I'm presuming that, you know, this seems to be a rather rough on people with underlying conditions. And so often that people with multiple disabilities have underlying conditions. Do you expect to see a growth and development with this virus then, once it opens up more and you're transporting more people and you're working with more people?
It's a really good question. So we felt like the governor's executive order yesterday that really laid out new guidelines really for people who are considered at risk.
Uh-huh.
And it was very specific about the types of medical conditions that people would be in that category. So if people are at risk, if they have had cancer, if they're immune compromised, if they have a kidney disease, there's a whole list of at-risk medical conditions, they will not be returning until it's safe to do so. So probably many of them, maybe until there's a vaccine. But those are the individuals we will target for, you know, providing remote supports or doing everything that we can to keep them safe, maybe working with them from home.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other people that we'll be able to bring in will be people who are not in those at-risk categories, at least for the first phase. One of the interesting things that we've learned, we have people who are working in different community businesses, right? And we've had work groups in companies where there might be an individual who has tested positive for COVID-19. And so we've worked through that process with our different business partners about what that would look like in terms of identifying who they've been in contact with and doing that contact tracing. And so that's all a part of our preparedness plan as well. So if someone should become ill, we have a whole plan in place to check with who else was on their route, for example, who else they've been in contact with, a whole notification process. We're required to notify the Minnesota Department of Health when there's any positive cases. So all of that is part of our preparedness plan And it's just our goal to keep people as healthy and safe as possible, at the same time giving them the choices and rights to be able to access the services that they want. So it's a balance there.
Yes. And so I'm wondering what happens. Let's say you have somebody at a workplace become positive. And I don't know how big your workplaces generally are, the day programs generally are, necessarily like one day program, but how many does it take before you shut it down, or what do you do? Because presumably everyone has been exposed that's in that particular center to that particular person. So what do you do then?
If we had a number of cases in one location, we would absolutely close that site down in order to do the research and notification for everyone who had come in contact with them. So even in a location where we might have, let's say 30 people, we're going to use different areas so that it doesn't happen that everybody would be in contact with everybody on every day, right? So that your group is going to be limited to a smaller number of people. And it'll be the those consistent people, so that you don't have the opportunity to infect a large number of people. And we're hoping that, you know, we'll do the best we can in monitoring and screening people so that they don't come if they're showing any symptoms of illness at all. And our team members have received a lot of training and guidance, not only on our plan, but also on infection control and other sanitary procedures and things, just to help everybody be on the same page about what it is that we're trying to accomplish now in supporting people in the safest way that we can.
So theoretically, there are some people that will be harder to keep a 6-foot distance from. You know, if you have somebody in a wheelchair and they need extra help, you will have to have a staff or somebody help them. Are the staff required to use gloves and masks?
Yep. If they're providing direct care to individuals like that, personal cares, we have a whole procedure for that where they would have PPE that they would wear, protective equipment that they would wear in those processes. And that's all part of our plan. And to be honest, you know, a lot of that was in place before, because some of those are just really good infection control procedures. And because we work with people with complex needs, you know, the last thing we want to do is be in a position just to, you know, infect them or spread an illness. So, we get guidance from a health organization with nurses that give us guidance on exactly what those procedures should look like. And we feel pretty confident in our ability to provide people with the support that they need safely.
Are the clients required to wear their masks once they get off the vehicle? If they go into the workplace, do they have to keep the mask on, or are they allowed to take it off?
So our plan is written that you need to wear the mask anytime you're not able to social distance. So definitely those transition times coming in and going out, people will need to wear the mask whenever they're involved in their program activity, they'll be social distance. And so we can give people breaks with the mask off if that's what they choose. So yes, but if there are times when people are moving throughout the building, even whether that's going to the restroom or anytime people are, any of us, not just the people we serve, but staff team members as well, have to wear masks when they could come in contact with someone else at less than 6 feet. So that's the way our plan is written today.
I want to just really understand, are the masks that the people have to wear when they get in the buses, are they required, or is this as you'd like them to wear it? Because it will make a difference, I think, how people react.
Yeah. So in transit, in our van, the masks are required. Whenever it's not possible to social distance, like in a vehicle, people are required to wear masks. And we know that some of the individuals we work with are going to have a challenge with that. One of the things that's really important to us at RISE is to be a person-centered organization. And so we've developed some training and support to try and work with people in a person-centered way to get used to a mask, what that's going to feel like. Just the sensoriness of it. I don't know
right.
if you've spent any time wearing a mask, but it's hot and it's hard for all of us. And so we're just going to have to really work with people to help them with that. And so one of the ways that you can, you know, I'm sure you probably do this, we all do this, is go outside to get away from the mask for a little bit. So if someone's really struggling with that, we could take them for a walk. Our staff team members will probably wear masks all the time, but we could get people a break from the mask if they need to. But definitely in transit, in order to be able to have safe transportation, people are going to have to wear a mask in transit, or they won't be able to do a shared ride like that. So another option maybe could be for them to have a family member bring them in, or their residential provider, if they'd be willing to just do a one-on-one ride with them. We'll try to figure out the best way to support people. But the mask going out in public for all of us has just become something new that's a part of our world for a while until there's a vaccine for this virus.
And are you still using Metro Mobility services for any transportation currently?
Yeah, we still have people who are going to work using Metro Mobility currently and riding the MTC bus. And people are in that situation. They can wear a mask. Most people are choosing to wear masks just because they feel safer out in public in that way. I know that it's not a requirement on the MTC bus that you have a mask,
mm-hmm.
but people... you know, we've been encouraging people to do what makes them feel most safe in that situation. And, you know, I believe the governor's and the Jan Malcolm, their suggestion to everyone from the Minnesota Department of Health was to wear a mask anytime you leave your home. And so that's one way, you know, we can all protect each other. And so for our folks, that's no different. We don't want people to infect other people or to get sick themselves. And so we'll work on that.
You know, there's some thoughts now that it will be a very long time till we go back to the world as we knew it. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah, it already feels like a very long time, right? But
yes.
I do think so. I think, you know, one of the things that has been just really interesting to me is how all of us have gotten so much better at using technology. And I think there's some things that we can learn from that as well. Our organization is a very people, touchy-feely kind of organization.
Yeah.
But we're never going to be able to go back to some of the... we're probably going to want people to work remotely just to have less people around to potentially infect each other. And so some of these practices are going to be in place for a long time. And I do think things are going to be different in the future.
How can people get involved or help with the legislator stuff?
One of the biggest ways for the public to get involved with legislators, if they have a heart for disability services, is to really just engage with your legislator and talk to them about, if you have a family member with a disability or you're aware of different services, because I think sometimes the biggest barrier for us is that people don't really know about these services. And we've done a lot of education in the past about our needs, and so what they see is an expense line, and they just don't know what those services mean in the lives of people. So all of us, to the extent that we can, you know, do a good job of just talking to legislators about how disability services are really important in the lives of people that we serve and in our communities, the great gifts and contributions that people make, people with disabilities make in their communities, and why that's important. All of us will be better for that. It's really about education and just helping to advocate for people being involved in their communities as much as possible, and that really takes a strong service network.
But everyone is pulling at them for money now, right?
Yeah.
So it is especially important that people get involved now, I think, because everyone's asking, and there is some amount of the squeaky wheel gets the oil, but
so true.
Also, you know, the idea that your voice is heard, right? So,
yeah. So right now, people could take a look at either MOHR, M-O-H-R, or RISE's Facebook page, and you'll see those public policy action alert asks right now. So if people are listening to this and they want to reach out, we make it really simple with the messaging that's on both the MOHR and RISE Facebook page or our website, or we use a lot of different social media to get that message out.
Well, Lynn, thank you so much. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, this has just been great. It's been really fun to talk to you tonight, Sam, and I hope you stay well and all the listeners stay well.
Yeah,
and that things just get better soon.
Yes. Well, thank you very, very much.
Yep. Take care.
Take care. Good night. This has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I've been the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research team. Matt Finkel has engineered this episode. Thank you, Matt. We were speaking with Lynn Noren tonight. Lynn is the CEO/president for RISE. And we're talking about the critical services for people with disabilities during this COVID time. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. Remember that we are podcast now, so please, if you didn't catch us, ask your smart speaker to hear Disability and Progress. Also, if you'd like to be on the email list, please email me at disabilityandprogress, all written out, at samjasmine.com. And if you have suggestions for the show, we love to hear them. So give those too. Thanks so much for tuning in.